Post-Harlan Monologics. Number 00012. Recorded on November 11, 2022. Production location, Post. Harlan. Texas. Chapter 12. Bucket of Tears. Bucket of Tears. Chapter 12.
The opinions of Maverick 88 are not necessarily the opinions of Maverick 88. Sensitive content warning. Viewer discretion is advised.
Now, buckle up. You are on the runaway train of thought. Ladies and gentlemen, without any further ado, the one, the only, Maverick 88.
When I was a teenager, I really had a problem with a lot of the older crew that kind of hung around after they graduated high school, right? You always got these guys, and I was friends with them on the one hand, and I'm friends with some of them even now, you know. But on the other hand, you had these guys that were graduated out of high school. They were up in their 20s and shit, and they didn't go to college. They pick up a local job around, and their nightlife was basically hanging out with we high school kids, right? Yeah, so there was several instances of, you know, being like 14, 15, 16, and you got girlfriends or girls that you hang around with, girls that are friends, that could be potential girlfriends down the line. You go to parties, and, you know, you expect it to be people your age, the girls are your age, but they are being wooed, right? Wooed. I don't like that word, but they're being wooed by guys who are like 10 years older than them. And what do you do? You know, what do you do? How do you compete? As a 15-year-old, how do you compete with somebody who's 23, 25, you know? They got a job, and they got money, they got the car, they got the cocaine, and that was the culture back then. You got the cocaine, you got the girl. It was kind of that easy. And you know, forgive me if you were the girls hanging around at that time, and maybe you beg to differ, but keep begging, because that's exactly the way it was in the 80s. You know, you all done pretty much anything for cocaine, and it was the guys who were graduated out of high school that were working full-time jobs and dealing on the side half the time. They had the cocaine, and they would go bring it to the little girl, and I fucking hated that. I hated that competition, you know, and I hated the idea of it in general. Now, you had a lot of people went off to college, right? People that went off to college, they mingled with their college. They got into a whole different life, a whole different style of life, but it was the ones that hung around town, had a hard time leaving, you know, and I got in fights with some of them. I got punched out by, cold cocked by one. Well, sort of kind of cold cocked by another one. Got my face all cut open with his high school ring, you know. And because I'm always mouthing off at him. Hell, I was mouthing off at bikers. I mean, biker bikers. I mean, one percenters that would hang. We had like a sort of like a hippie slash biker ranch house in the neighborhood, and you know, there was a girl that lived there that was our age. We hung out there all the time. All the deadheads, right? All the deadheads in town hung out over there, and I had a bunch of friends that were deadheads, and so I hung out over there too. I wasn't necessarily a deadhead per se, but you know, it was the first concert I went to. I was not unfamiliar. I know most of the songs. I've heard them 1,000 times over because of the company that I kept. And a lot of that, those experiences were over at this one particular house. But that one particular house had people that lived there that were drug dealers. And the bikers would come in and out of town on their travels and shit. They'd hang around. We'd have like little, I guess you call it like a grill outs or barbecues or so, just, you know, hanging out, drinking beer in the back. And you got like 10, 12, 15, 20 people Saturday afternoon. And you got like a fucking 38, 45 year old dirty biker who's like putting him moves on a 15 year old girl. And I, like I always did, took issue with that, you know, and I spoke up and I called him all kinds of names and insulted. He wanted to kill me. They wanted to kill me. People had to hold him down. People had to hold me down. I just happened to have a buddy with me who was like my equal, right? He was my size. He was a year older than me. Good friend of my freshman year in high school. Everybody loves it, dude. He's up in Massachusetts now. I'm not going to name any names or anything like that, but he moved shortly thereafter. But he was a guy who was able to hold me back, and we left. We left, and all the fight I had in me, he fought with me. We walked across a large field and just tumbled the whole way, you know. He's trying to hold me down from getting killed by some biker, and he was getting between me and that fight. So he got the fight, and he's a good guy. He's a good guy. And that was actually fun. It ended up laughing, you know, because we were so equal in ability that nobody could ever win that, you know. We were the same size, same weight, same strength, a lot of same attitude. And it was really, really an interesting thing, you know. All's well that ends well, I guess. But the fact of the matter is these old dudes preying on children, right? Like you stick around. You're going to hear me talk about related things like that. I just don't like that. I know that kids at a younger age than any parent wants to ever think that their kid is capable of, they get into some wild shit, right? That's it was a reality back then. It's a reality now. It is what it is, you know? Girls are always looking for the guys, and the guys are always looking for the girls, and that starts fifth or sixth grade for a lot of people. By the time you get to high school, you've tried a couple of things along the way, generally speaking. Not everybody. Some people are more innocent than others, but it's out there. And and I don't mind it. Obviously, it's not morally within the ways of God. But I kind of look at it more as kind of like a recess, a playground at recess, you know. Kids do what kids do with other kids, and just let them be on their playground doing it, and don't step in and dance with it. Don't try to become a kid. Let the kids be the kids, whatever they're doing, you know. You got different kinds of them that are in the shit, and then there's some that aren't. The ones that aren't, they keep away from the stuff, you know, that they keep themselves clean. And the ones that get into it, just let them do it with other kids. Oops. Anyway, it pissed me off. But, you know, it reminds me of so many different times, because it was just prevalent, you know. Whatever age I was in high school, there was always somebody like 10 years older that was interested in the same girls that I was interested in, you know. There was that competitive element, and I won. Yeah, but I won my share of times, you know. It wasn't a competition alone that I hated. It was the idea of it, because I would look at myself I was what you would call in high school a burnout, right? I was a burnout in high school. And I'm looking at my life 5-10 years down the road. Is this going to be me hanging around this shitty fucking town with girls? Like, you know, say I'm 16 years old. That puts me in the, what, 10th grade? So I'm looking at, you know, 5 years down the line, I'm going to be preying on girls that are currently in the 5th grade when I'm in the 10th. And 5 years after that, girls who are in fucking kindergarten, right? So just think about that. High school in 10th grade, and somebody just put their kid on the school bus for the first time to go off to kindergarten. And this guy in 10th grade in high school is going to be preying on that child when she gets to high school. Because he's on drugs and never left town, you know. The people that left town got on with their life. The ones who stuck around, Not everybody was that way, of course. Not everybody, most of them weren't. There was a couple of odd ones. And like I said, I'm even friendly with some of these people. But I was just not good with that. Like, I remember I had a bunch of girlfriends down, it was my freshman year in high school, you know. Friends that were girls, actual girlfriends in the mix. And yeah, we hung out in their neighborhood. They had a pizza parlor nearby and dead end road that we hung out at, drank beer and smoked pot. And it was on the other side of town from where I come from. But we used to go out there all the time, right? I had a lot of friends in that general area. And, yeah, we'd hang out and we'd do our thing. And then, you know, this guy would come around who, I didn't know him. He graduated high school. Like, we were freshmen, right? He graduated before that. I don't know, a year or two or 3 years before that. I never went to school with the guy. He was that old, you know? And there he'd pull up and he had this big old giant green, I'm guessing like 75 or 76 Challenger, right? Just like three blocks long, big tires in the back, little tires in the front, kind of. It was on that pitch like a high heel shoe. And he'd come around at night. I guess he worked in the day. He'd come around at night and we'd all pile in at a car. It was mostly girls and then him. And then there'd be like the odd guy like me or somebody else. Maybe it's the same old buddy I was telling you about that we, you know, wrestled across the field, right? Because he was part of that scene at that time. And, you know, we'd all pile into this car, you know, sitting on each other's laps and shit like that. And he would just drive around. And, you know, all you had was, like, the lights off of his console and dashboard, the stereo. And, you know, we're smoking pot and snorting whatever and drinking whatever and just driving around. You know, this is the early 80s. And it was like being in a spaceship. I gotta say, you know, I got a problem with the old dudes that hang around and who are, you know, trying to make way with these young girls. But it was like cruising around in a spaceship, right? This fucking car. It was a nice car. And, you know, it just sat in a certain way. And just when it was dark outside, the lights, the way everything was on the interior. And you're getting stoned. He's got the music cranking. And, you know, he was doing it for the girl. He would play the girls' music of the day. All the burnout girls back then, they listened to more or less the same shit. Like the guys, you know, were guys. And the masculine music was Led Zeppelin, for one example. And then any kind of like old metal, like, you know, granddaddy metal, like Black Sabbath. You know, that's what the guys listened to. That's what they were into. And but the girls, they listened to that, but they had their own little line of pop/rock that they got into. And it was like Billy Squire, right? Billy Squire had an album. And I don't know if he ever made another album, right? It was Just Say No. Half the songs were on the radio all the fucking time, you know, and on MTV. And these girls just listened to them all the time. And the 38 Special, right? It was that. I call it pseudo Southern rock. They're a Southern rock band, right? I think the singer was Ronnie Van Zant from Lynyrd Skynyrd's brother. Donnie or Johnny, or there's all these Van Zants in the Southern rock scene, and they come from the same place, Jacksonville area, down in Florida, but they really didn't have that kind of down-home, gritty, bluesy feel that Lynyrd Skynyrd had and Allman Brothers out of Georgia had. They were a little bit more kind of pop-rocky, and the girls kind of really took to it. And the guys did not. I don't think I ever owned the 38 Special album. It just wasn't quite there for me. I loved Lynyrd Skynyrd. I had everything they ever made up to that point, like up to the plane crash point. And then like the First and Last and the Golden Platinum, which is a great album. That's probably, if I got stranded on a desert island, I'm taking Golden Platinum with me. I would take the First album, Pronounce Lynyrd Skynyrd, but most of the songs are on Golden Platinum, and Golden Platinum's got an extra album on it, so it's like I'd probably go with that. I loved the original Lynyrd Skynyrd, the 70s Lynyrd Skynyrd. After that, not so much, you know. They lingered and malingered on for years and years. I've never seen them. They formed up a band that was kind of like the remnants of Lynyrd Skynyrd, and it became like a precursor to what was to come with Lynyrd Skynyrd, called Rossington Collins Band. They made two albums. I bought the first one right away, and I was trying to get my ass to one of their concerts that they were playing down in Holmdel, New Jersey. It was the Garden State Arts Center. It's called, I don't know what, they changed it to like the PNC Bank Arts Center, and probably like five other fucking corporately sponsored there. But it used to be the Garden State Arts Center down to Shore, halfway down to Shore, Holmdel, New Jersey, by the bays, you know, like by Kingsburg and Keyport and all that. Middletown, whatever. And, nah, I never did get to see that, and that's about as close as I ever came. I looked through the years every once in a while. I mean, they played constantly. They're always touring around. They did a lot of festivals, and you know, I don't like a lot of festivals. I like to go see what I want to see and get out and get home. I'm not big into crowds and shit. And arena stuff, big productions, I'm just not. I like bars and clubs and accessibility. I'll talk about that sort of thing eventually, somewhere along the way. The 38 Special, REO Speedwagon, right? All the girls were listening to REO Speedwagon. The guys hated REO Speedwagon, and still do. Journey, same thing. Journey was a girls' band for whatever reason. The guys didn't care for it. And, you know, so the guy would play this. I'm not going to name a name. Tubby, what'd you call him? He was kind of tubby, right? He's kind of down the tubby side, you know, a little soft, a little pasty. I don't even know what he was doing for a living at that point. I had no idea. He wasn't even from the neighborhood. I don't know where the fuck he came from. Somewhere in town. He went to the high school we went to, but he had graduated a few years before us, and he was just kind of still malingering. And somehow he knew these girls in this neighborhood, and you know, none of them ever like ran off and became the dude's girlfriend or anything like that. Let's just call him Tubby. All right? Let's just go with Tubby. And Tubby liked Rush. Now, when he was done amusing the girls and playing the girls' music, then he would pop out Rush, right? Rush. In fact, that's when I first heard 2112. I had my own Rush up to that point. Now, I got to tell you, I was never a huge Rush fan. To this day, I'm not. Because Geddy Lee, I can't take Geddy Lee's voice. Musically, they're very good. They're unique, obviously highly gifted and talented. But I can't take Geddy Lee's voice. I don't like the pitch, the enunciation. It's just, I don't like it. I'm sorry. It's just like, I don't like broccoli either. And half y'all do. It's just a taste thing. And I never could. But, yeah, when they just jammed, they had a couple instrumental types of songs. And this is what we'd get on 2112. It would start out with that instrumental, you know, overture, right? And 2112 was the name of the album, but the first side of it, the A side, was the whole 2112 song broken down into parts. But it would start, and anytime I rarely ever hear it anymore, but whenever I do, you know, the beginning of 2112 overture, those sound effects, kind of like the 70s laser beam, kind of like Star Wars opening. Da-dun! Da-da-dun! Da-dun-dun-dun-dun-dun! And, you know, it goes into that with the guitar and the bass and the drums. I always think about this big fucking green giant 75 Challenger, right? It puts me right back there. You know, I was always in the back seat and jammed up in the fucking middle, and girls sitting on my lap and, you know, passing the pipe around, smoking weed. It was a good time, you know. No, I didn't like the old dudes hanging around, but it was a good time, you know, a good time. Yeah, but that's Geddy Lee's voice. But I don't know. Maybe you don't know Rush. Rush, R-U-S-H, just like it sounds. Rush, they're a band from Canada, and their drummer is probably the greatest rock and roll drummer. I'm an old Led Zeppelin head with John Bonham, and, you know, as the years go by and I wait in the balance, I think that this Neil Peart, or Perch, people say it different ways, I'm going to have to say he's probably the best all-around rock drummer ever that I've ever heard of or seen, heard play, whatever. I didn't see him. I never did go to a Rush concert. Rush always was coming around. And every time it's like, yeah, I got some tickets. We're going to go see Rush. You want to go? Nah, I'll catch him next year. And I never did. You know, I never did. Probably a great show. They were probably, you know, they're the arena rock band, and their music was geared toward that, you know, take a little acid, smoke a little weed, and it's probably a good time. I never made it, you know, I just never made it. Like I said, never a huge fan. Rush, they're from Canada, right? They're from Ontario, Canada, I think Toronto area. Some of their songs use French language, so I wonder. Most of the lyrics were written by the drummer. I wonder if he's maybe got an association back into Quebec. I don't know. He may or may not. I don't know their biographies or anything like that. What I know about that guy is he played great drums. He liked making concept albums. His lyrics weren't bad. It's just what they were about was kind of eh. You know? In a lot of cases, some of them not. There's some good songs that he wrote. And then they're wrecked by Geddy Lee's voice. But, yes, I don't know. I don't know. He was into motorcycles as an adult. I've heard stories. I think he had some kind of autobiography. Somebody was telling me about it. Or I saw some kind of video or documentary. I don't know. I caught it somewhere. He just died in the past year. So there was a whole lot of to-do about him and his life. So I probably just happened onto something on social media. But apparently he was into taking a motorcycle with them on their tour. And, you know, they'd play a show somewhere, and before they left for somewhere else, he'd get on his motorcycle and just ride around toward the area. Sometimes maybe even ride out to the next date alone. Maybe have a roadie tailing behind him in case something, I don't know. He's into motorcycles, and that's not a bad thing. So yeah, they're from Canada, like from the Toronto area, I think. Who else famous from the Toronto area? And they got to do a little bit of reaching. I'm sure there's some bands. You know, Neil Young is from Canada. I don't know where. There was a band called April Wine in the 70s. I like to rock. I like to rock. I had, that was a song that I picked up on 8-track. I used to record the radio onto a 8-track when I was like in 6th grade, 7th grade, and I was getting my first doses of rock and roll music, you know, rock music, hard rock, as it was, off of WPLJ 95.5 on your radio dial in New York City, right? New York City. Yeah, it's April Wine. But in my mind, the most famous musicians out of the Toronto area is the Islington School Boys Choir. Islington School Boys Choir. Now, I know a lot of you are out there like, who the fuck and why the fuck, right? Listen. Islington School Boys Choir out of Toronto was the choir of students that Pink Floyd brought in to do those vocals on another Brick in the Wall Part 2, right? And I just heard a Roger Waters interview recently where he's talking about it. He goes on his tours and they still play that song and they still got to bring kids in. So wherever they go on their, you know, wherever they are on their tour dates, they find somebody locally to provide like a boys choir to sing that part in that song. Isn't that interesting? So yeah, but the one that actually made it onto the studio album is from Toronto, right? And that's when you're a Pink Floyd fan, you pick up useless information like that. So yeah, so you got the Islington School Boys Choir and Rush and maybe April Wine, right? And that's all. There's probably a million others. I just don't know. I'm American, you know. It amazes me that I know so much about British rock because fuck Britain, right? You know, Rush. I had mentioned 8-track, right? The 8-track medium for playing recordings. I had Permanent Waves, right? That was from what, 77, 78? A Rush album, Permanent Waves. Had probably their biggest song of note, Spirit of Radio. Really, really good song, right? That was on that 8-track, as it was. You know, I had the Permanent Waves 8-track. That was my first Rush. And then when Moving Pictures came out a year or two later. Moving Pictures was, what, 1980? 79, 80. A lot of good albums came out at the end of 79, beginning of 80. 79 was a good year for music. But it was also like the last year of all these 70s dinosaur type of bands, the Led Zeppelins and Yes and Rush. I mean, these bands kept going, like Yes kept on playing, but they changed, right? They did their Yes Drama album, and I don't want to go off on this tangent. All these prog rock bands just started dropping out. Rock and roll bands in general, Eagles, right? Completely different genre. They did the Long Run album, right? Led Zeppelin, of course, John Bonham died. They had just got In Through the Outdoor Out. I remember, you know, up at pizzeria being a fucking kid. Cigarettes in the machine were 35 cents a pack and nobody would stop you. You'd be 14 years old up there. And they had a jukebox in the corner and the Fool in the Rain was on it. You know, Fool in the Rain and All My Love was on the jukebox, Led Zeppelin. And, you know, we had like 10, 12 kids that were in there. We'd play Asteroids, right? Asteroids on the, you know, that monochrome game, the video game. And I wasn't one for wasting my quarters, but, you know, a lot of kids did. But we'd hang out there. We'd eat pizza, play Asteroids, and everybody on the jukebox. All you heard was those two Led Zeppelin songs over and over again. The Long Run song, I think, from the Eagles was on there with something else. That got played all the time. But it was all these, like, you know, 70s rock songs in the pizzeria. And, you know, that was our version of Arnold's from Happy Days, right? We had the pizzeria, the Italian pizzeria in the middle of town up there when we were 13, 14, 15. I hung out in there. Good times, good times. Yeah, so I had 2112. I got Moving Pictures. Oh, well, I didn't have 21. Sorry. I had Permanent Waves. Then I got Moving Pictures when it came out, right around that time. And, eventually I got it when I got into high school as a freshman. This is when I was hanging out with this car, the tubby guy with the big green car. And I didn't hang out with him, I hang out with the girls. And he was hanging out with the same girls. I don't think I have a moment alone with that guy that I can recall. Like, we drove off somewhere or we sat down and had a beer, you know. It was always about the girls. That's what I mean to say. Yeah, and, but he always wanted to play Rush 2112. And like I mentioned, 2112, it's like two-sided, you know, it's album, two sides, A and B. The first side is a song called 2112, which is actually broken down into sections that have their own titles to them, right? The Priest of the Temples of Syrinx and the Grand Finale and, you know, just different things. It was a concept song, right? 20-minute long concept song broken into these parts. And You know, my favorite Rush song is one of the parts of 2112. So it sucks now. Like, if I want to download it, I have to download the whole 20-minute rendition just to hear this one little three-minute part. It's called Soliloquy, right? Soliloquy. That's a fancy word for you. When I first saw that on the album, I didn't even know what the fuck that meant. I had to look it up. And I remember soliloquy is basically a spoken suicide note, right? It comes from to be or not to be, right? From Shakespeare. That's a soliloquy. So in this story, you've got this character who, for some reason, and I know what the reason is. I don't want to go into the whole story of 2112, but he's debating killing himself, right? And I related to that heavily at that age. So, hey, there was my favorite Rush song. There was even Geddy Lee vocals in it. They actually fit well. They suited that, and there wasn't much of them. Soliloquy. That was the song I liked by Rush most of all. On that album, when you flipped it over, then it just had some unrelated, one-off songs. The hell was on there? I don't know. One of them was called Tears. Now, I know that. I play that on guitar, actually. It's not that difficult to get figured out. Yeah, it's very acoustic. They played on a 12-string. I don't have a 12-string. So I play it on all my various acoustic guitars when I do, you know. I've played it live on Facebook with people tuning in when I used to do, like, in the COVID era, I would get on live on Facebook and every Saturday morning for a little bit more than a year, religiously, you know, up there with a cup of coffee and a guitar and a Bible, and basically preach messages of encouragement to people to get them through that really fucked up time, you know. That was my thing. I felt strong, you know. I felt like I got eyes on the prize, that my faith carries me, and I decided to step up and do something positive for humanity for a change. And in that process, some of the songs that I would play, part of my repertoire was this Rush song called Tears, right? Tears. And tears, you know, my tears now, you know, my tears, because I'm on my break at my job, you know, and I'm just, this day started, me walking around doing policing the lot of the place, right? We got a employee side in the back, we got a retail customer side in the front, and, you know, there's no difference between the two of them. The employees and the customers alike, they're just pigs. They just throw shit all over the fucking place, you know, and you got to go out and pick it up. Who gets to pick it up? Dwayne Schneider gets to go pick it up, right? So I get the Nifty Nabber, right? The Nifty Nabber, that's literally what this device is called. It's some kind of, I don't know, what the fuck you even call it? You squeeze a trigger, right? There's a handle, it's a long pole, about 3 foot long, and it's got two little clasps on the end of on the bottom of it that come together when you squeeze the handle trigger. You know, there's some kind of tension action in there, and you pick up, you know, somebody throws your Starbucks cup on the ground, it's blowing around in the wind in a circle, and you get there with the Nifty Nabber and stab at it and pick it the fuck up. And then what do you do with it? You throw it in the little orange Home Depot bucket that you're dragging alongside of you, and it's collecting all your tears, right? That's where my tears go. My tears go in the Home Depot bucket along with all the garbage of this fucking city. At the Home Depot bucket. Home Depot bucket is like the device of a million fucking uses, though. I gotta say. You know, I use it for that, right? Picking up trash on the grounds. I think they were originally meant for paint, because you find them when you go to Home Depot. They're in the paint section, usually stacked up. So I think the painters use them as paint buckets, and that's probably their primary original use. But we use it at the house. We got some spigots that rise up out of the ground. They don't come off the house. They rise up out of the ground. Old style shit, right? So when the winter comes and you have the threat of freezing temperature, we chuck Home Depot buckets over the top of it, and somehow, some way, magically, it prevents those spigots from freezing up and whatnot. And it's not a hypothesis. It ain't no theory. We've been doing it for years and never had a problem. So I got Home Depot buckets. I got one in the front, one in the back, you know. It looks funny, but it's about practicality. You know, one day when I really have my shit together, we'll get some style points in on top of that, too. I don't know. But, yeah, we use it for the spigot cover. I use it for cleaning brass, right? You know, I got the tumble method. It's just like this plastic cage. You put all your brass in it after you've run it through the tumbler, right? Now you got to separate the brass from the media that you're tumbling it in. So this little plastic cage will catch the brass and it will let all the media fall through the bottom. And you tumble it also to shake it all out. Well, when you shake it all out, it drops into the bottom of what? A fucking Home Depot bucket. So I use it for that. I've used Home Depot buckets, or at least something similar to a Home Depot bucket. You know, I got one that was green in color. I didn't want to use orange because I had a kayak, right? I once upon a time was a kayak fisherman. I technically still am. I just haven't done it in 2 years. But I had a kayak that I had beat the shit out of with all the frequency of going out on the lake. We got a couple of big lakes around here. Go out catching catfish and bass and shit, right? Get a suntan, get your head cleared out. Just a good time being out on the lake. But you know, you drag the kayaks around long enough, the bottom will wear out. They're kind of plastic, a polymer, and you know, they'll wear through. You get a hole in it and then you start taking water and then you're in trouble, right? So I had a kayak that needed patching up, and I found out that, you know, if you take a Home Depot bucket, it's the exact right kind of plastic. The plastics have numbers on them. If you look at the bottom of it, there's a little indicator, like number 2 or there's, I forget what the number is. It was a couple of years ago I did this. But you kind of go through a process of melting this plastic down over the holes that you have, and you could patch up your kayak with it, right? And that's what I did. That was another use for the Home Depot bucket. This year, we decided we were going to try growing tomato plants. It was a bad year to do. It was a drought year. It was really hot. Never a cloud in the sky. The sun just burned down, and our tomatoes just never really worked out. But when we started them out, we went to transfer them to something else. We couldn't just stick them in the ground because we've got some kind of critters around in our backyard that are eating up all our peppers and shit, and you know, any tomato that would pop up, it's all suddenly gone. And the dogs, you know, we've got a territorial male chihuahua that wants to hike his leg up on everything. So if you put a plant in the ground, he's just gonna piss on it, you know that. The other one, you know, the pit bull, he's just exuberant. If he sees another dog or something in the neighborhood, he'll just start running around like an idiot, drooling all over the fucking place with tongue hanging outside the side of his mouth. And he'll trample. He'll just run right over them. You know, so you can't do it. So what we did, we made kind of like a redneck raised garden. We got Home Depot buckets, right? And I cut a hole in the bottom of them so the roots can go down the ground, cut the grass away, just stuck them there. You filled them up with dirt and put the tomatoes in there. Gets them up off the ground. They don't get pissed on. They don't get knocked over. And it looked like a good idea, but we just had a really bad year. We'll try it again next year. You can use these things for anything, you know. The Home Depot bucket, a couple of dollars. You can get cheaper ones at Harbor Freight. They're red and they cost like half the price. You know, so obviously, you know, and we got trash in the ground. You got the nifty nabber, and it's what I do with my job. It's like a part of, I call it the walkabout, right? I do a walkabout outside a couple of times a week, just picking up all the fucking garbage that the customers leave behind and the employees leave behind. And you know what? If we don't have enough customers and employees in the world to piss me off on a given day, well, you just get a wind out of the south and everything blows over from the shopping center across the street. Everybody throws their circulars down, their receipts down, their cigarette butts down. Everything blows over here, you know? And it gets caught over here because all the fencing that we got around them, it catches everything. So it doesn't leave. It doesn't just blow across this property onto somebody else's. No, it all ends up here. Everything that's dumped down on the ground in this city, you know, assholes driving by in their car a mile away. something from the McDonald's half a mile down the street ends up in this parking lot somehow, blowing in, getting caught in a bus. I had fucking tumbleweed roll up here one day a couple years ago. Tumbleweed. Tumbleweed you get like out in West Texas in the desert. Where the fuck did that come from? This big thing of tumbleweed just tumbled onto the... fucking A. But anyway, that's my tears, though. You know, my tears. All the different shit that I got to pick up around here, from crack pipes to wine bottles, beer cans, cigarette butts, every kind of fucking snack cake you can imagine, every kind of fast food bag and french fry little box container, every Starbucks size coffee cup and their lids and everything. It's the same shit all the time, you know. You get the odd kids toy, you know, you get like a, what they call it, the Happy Meal at McDonald's, and you get the little plastic toy. Kid opens the door of the car, he's going to go inside with his parents, and kicks his little fucking McToy out on the ground, you know, and then when they back out, they run right over it, so now you got all these little splintered up pieces of plastic that I got to get the nifty nabber on, and it's just shit, you know, shit, and more fucking shit. I'm only beginning. Used condoms, baby diapers, shitted up human diapers. Figure that the fuck out, you know? Human underwear, you know, with the tidy whities with just shit in it. These things happen. I don't know how or why of it all, but yeah, that's kind of some of the stuff that you get. You know, tampons. Oh, here's a good one. COVID masks. There was a time I was picking up upwards of like 25 of them off the fucking ground in a day. Just on the, like, customer side, right? Everybody, you know, they're doing their virtue signaling, wearing their fucking masks, and when nobody's looking, they just throw them on the fucking ground. Walk away. You know? Oh, whatever. Don't get me started with that. That was the most ridiculous thing. And I'll tell you, these are going to go down in history the same way like platform shoes did in the 70s. It's just like the fucking dumbest fashion shit. Well, the platform shoes came back, didn't they, in the 2000s. So, all right, come up with something better. The 70s just had all kinds of... go with the polyester suits, right? Polyester suits. The COVID mask era as a fashion statement is going to go down in history equivalent, maybe even worse, probably worse because it's even more dumb than the polyester suits of the 70s. Think about, what was that show? Three's Company, right? Yeah, the one guy living with the three girls and all that. Whatever, you know, the fucking sophomore comedy that goes around with all those sexual tension situations and general goofiness around there. And you had the guy, Mr. Furley, who was managing the apartment complex. I think it was Don Knotts, right? Barney Fife. He was always wearing those polyester suits and those little pseudo ascot fucking silk ties. And, you know, that was the 70s. And it wasn't generally young people. That was kind of like the 40s style, the middle age, what do I call it? Midlife crisis clothing of the day. I mean, I had uncles and shit. They dressed like that, you know. Oh, shit, you know. Yeah, but I take that over the masks. The masks were just a whole different level of civil stupidity. So anyway, yeah, my tears, you know, my tear. I cry every day, just the condition of humanity. My job has got me 90% of the time just looking straight up the asshole of humanity. And, it makes you want to cry, you know. I cry tears until my Home Depot bucket of tears, right? Like the crying Indian, you know. So talk about the 70s again. I don't know. It might have been a local thing. It might have been a New York City metropolitan area public service announcement, because it was suitable. Fucking New York dirty as it was and probably still is. They had these ads, right? Commercials, probably a PSA, and it was like this crying Indian dude, right? He paddling around on some river in a canoe. He had like the, you know, birch bark canoe, and he's paddling around, and he comes around the bend, and he pulls, you know, there's just like this trash that's spinning around in a little circle up against a bank somewhere, and he paddles down a little bit more, and he comes ashore onto the bank, and it's just covered in all kinds of waste and bottles and cans and whatever, diapers, just filth, pollution, right? The water's all funky and like brown foam, and he starts walking around, and there's more garbage there. You get the idea. It's like everywhere this Indian goes, right? When I say Indian, I mean Native American. He had the whole like buckskin suit on with the fringes and all that shit, right? That feather in the head, and you know, just a traditional Native American, like Plains Indian, paddling around in a canoe in outside of New York City somewhere, basically, right? And you know, behind them in the background, you got these factories belching out the soot, you know. And then he turns over here, looks over this overlook, and there's like all this bumper to bumper traffic and all the smog coming up, the carbon dioxide and monoxide and the noxious poison gases from hell, and everything is black and nasty. And finally, they just pan in on the guy's face, and he just, one single tear just drops out of his eye and rolls down his cheek, right? See, he's the crying Indian. He was known as the crying Indian. It was all about pollution. Pollution making what? The Native American sad. And we should all be saddened by it, you know? And what they say, people start pollution, people can stop it, right? That was the saying. Yeah, it was down to us. And obviously, 50 years later, can't go fuck yourself. I'm throwing my cigarette pack on the ground. Blow me. Eat my fucking condom, you know? Yeah. Here's my can of beer. It's empty. Don't worry, you know? The guy, his name was Iron Eyes Cody. Iron Eyes Cody. And I don't know his story. I kind of vaguely recall somebody saying he wasn't a real Indian. He was a like an Italian acting like one, like the guy on F Troop, right? The chief on, what was it? Chief, there was, the one was Crazy Cat. The other one was Chief. I can't remember, but he was like an Italian actor that they did up like an Indian. And I think this guy also, Iron Eyes Cody, was, to the best of my recollection, and I could be wrong, either he was Italian or accused of it or something. He did not speak for Native American people. There was a little bit of a to-do about it all somewhere along the way. But I think through his life, he portrayed a Native American, you know, and he had that name, Iron Eyes Cody, and something you ought to look up on your own. But he's the crying Indian, and you know, me out here, you know, the Dwayne Schneider of this fucking town of post-Arlen, Texas, I'm like the cowboy version of the crying Indian. I'm the cowboy version of Iron Eyes Cody, you know. People start pollution, people can stop it. Now, in the new millennium, I would like to add to that that fuck it, we just won't, okay? People can start pollution, people can stop it, but fuck it, we just won't. There's your new PSA for the new millennium. Other tears, you know, this walkabout, though, you know, probably a more of a serious note, right? My walkabout on these grounds, the first couple years I was working here, it was, I had some hard times in my life, you know. It's a really long story, and I'm not meaning to get into the whole thing of it all, but I took this job to get back to Texas, right? I was in the depths of hell. I was stuck up north for a couple of months, and I don't want to get into how that happened right here now. I'll talk about that at some point, but not now. I needed to get the hell back here to Texas. I had been away for a little bit and I needed to get the fuck back, and I just took what I could get, right? I took a job that I could get, and it was really a spiritual time in my life. I had just recently, a couple of months prior, jettisoned what I call the albacore around my neck, you know. It's the albatross, but on The Sopranos it's referred to as the albacore. One of those Italian dudes, one of those mafiosos, called probably Paulie Walnuts or Big Pussy. Could have been Tony Soprano. Somebody made a reference to the burden of their life as the albacore around their neck. Albacore is a big tuna fish, right? So it's funny, just the visualization, you know. And in my case, I'm calling a woman an albacore around my neck. So she's like a burden, and at the same time, a tuna. You make of that what you will, okay? That's between you, God, and the devil. But I needed to get the hell out of that and back to Texas. And, you know, I had this kind of prayer. I made this commitment with God that I would do anything to get back here. I would even clean toilets if that's what it took, right? Because cleaning toilets was fucking beneath me, and I know it's beneath you. So, but to get back to Texas, I would clean toilets. And I ended up getting this job that involves cleaning toilets. That's exactly what happened, and I had to follow through with it. And like all this, you know, once I got that albacore off of my back, I entered into this really spiritual part of my life, because she was the one basic immoral thing that I was doing consistently. I was in a relationship with her, living with her out of wedlock. And it turns out, it just so happens that God frowns upon that. And when I walked away from that situation, there was a lot that came off of my shoulders. And I, you know, my sense of the presence of God in my life magnified and multiplied exponentially. But I was also in dire straits. I was dirt poor. I was really up against it. It just, I don't want to get into it all, but I was really up against it. And I entered into this new situation. This fucking job that I complain about all the time. Really in deep need and dire straits every day. Every day. And for the first like year or two, I just was mounting all kinds of challenges. A lot of it was social stuff, you know. There was bad involvements with women that I was dating. I married somebody that I should not have. That was just a fucking nightmare. It didn't last a couple of months even. It was just stupid. Stupid. You know, I was lied to, deceived, and I walked into something on blind faith. And it was completely fucking wrong. But I didn't know what to make of it all at the time. So, very long story, totally fucking blotted out, redacted, and cut short. I walked around with the weight of the world on my shoulders while I'm doing this walkabout on this job with this nifty nabber dropping trash into this Home Depot bucket of fucking tears, right? And I prayed is what I did. I just it would be like a 45-minute walkabout typically, depending on the volume of the general piggedness of our local humanity. Texas as it is, you know, post Arlen specifically, DFW. And now I'd be praying to God and having conversations with God for every second of these 45 minutes, praying every prayer with tears in my eyes, literally tearing up every other day, you know? And it became a routine. It's just like something, you know, like some people need a drink after work every fucking day, right? I needed to have this walkabout, this prayer, and this little cry with God on a daily basis. That's what it became. I came into work, I did this, I did that, and then I grabbed that bucket, and I grabbed that nifty nabber, and I went outside and did that, right? And even to this day, I don't do that as frequently anymore. They got me on a schedule and shit, and the schedule precludes me from spending time doing this. So when I do it, it takes twice as long, but I do it half as frequently, right? I start walking, and like my natural thing to do is start praying, right? But the emotions are not the same. The difficulties are not there anymore. It's all been overcome. But man, the way it was back then, it was just, And it went further than just like prayers and tears. It would get to like the heartache, the depth of the emotion, and the sense of connection with the creator of all things in these moments. I mean, it was for real. And I was having visions at times, actually. Which may sound a little bit crazy, but if you think I'm fucking crazy, then you think I'm fucking crazy. But I can remember some of this. Like, I remember like going through this whole process into the divorce thing over that stupid, shitty marriage that really wasn't a marriage at all. Yeah, I was standing by, I got a shed for all like the grounds equipment and everything, with my bucket of tears. And like, I don't know what happened. Something just came over me, and I had this vision. It was like, it's kind of holographic. How do you even say it? It was that woman, that wife. But it's like, you know, Star Trek, right? I've been watching a lot of Star Trek. They got the transporter, right? And they get those moments, certain scenes where the transporter doesn't totally fucking work. Like somebody gets zapped out of existence or into existence, and like it only goes halfway. And you kind of see like these like purplish light outlines of the form of the person that was only partially transported, right? It was something like that. It was this woman's face just looking at me, and like it wasn't a still shot. It was like the eyes were moving, expressions were kind of shifting, and it was just there, like hovering and staring at me. It was talking, but no sound, right? The lips were moving, but your lips move, but I can't hear what you're saying, right? It was like that, and it was just weird, and it lasted for like maybe 30 seconds. But I'm standing there. I'm not like meditating. I'm not asleep. I'm not on drugs. I'm literally just in my prayer. And this happens. And then it fades away. And then I'm like, what the fuck was that, right? And that was one vision. And I don't know. What does it mean to me? I don't know. That was the last I ever saw her. I can tell you that. I'd never seen her again. But I don't know what that was. That was just fucking weird. But that happened on my walkabout, you know? And there was another one. I don't remember in detail. I wish I did, because this turned out to be very interesting. There was a vision that I had that involved like the growing of a flower. Actually, two flowers together. You know, like two seeds were like in one spot. And oh, how did it go? One of the seeds was a piece of my broken heart. Like if you had your heart broken and you just dropped it, like, you know, you had your heart in your hand and you dropped it on the ground and it shattered like glass, right? The vision was like this. There was one little shard of a broken heart picked up, and then it was put like in the ground with a seed of some sort, and then this plant starts growing up. And it was like one flower wrapped up with another flower. One was, they were like intermingled as they were growing up taller. Right? That was the basic vision of it all. It was like something about a flower. And I remember, it's like, okay, I equated that, because obviously the broken heart part and everything like that, that to me, that meant something. And what that meant was God had something in the future for me. And it had something to do with the flower. And, you know, two people growing together. And so immediately, you know, retard that I am, I just start looking around. Anything that had anything to do with a flower, like, registered with me, right? And it turned out, like, online, I met somebody, you know, through this friend and that friend. Ended up in some arbitrary online conversation. And we started, like, talking. I live a long way away from here, right? All the way down in San Antonio, as it was. And we started having like this online relationship. Why? I don't know. But I could tell you this. She had in a biker community, you get road names, right? A nickname they call you. And hers was Wildflower, right? Wildflower. And when I heard that, I was like, oh, right? So it was like this connection is happening online. And now here's that flower thing that I've kind of had my antenna up looking for, right? Because of my vision. This is part of like the very odd, strange, mystical side of myself, right? I have an inner mystic in me. So along with the inner nerd and the inner woman and the inner Dwayne Schneider and the inner Spock. And, you know, I've got this inner mystic. He's like my level 33 mage, right? And then, yeah, so it was like the flower thing. I'm chasing this vision around, and she's the wildflower. It turned out, no, she was wild, all right, you know, but she was not the flower. She was the diversion away from it. She was the mistake that was laid out before me, and I read it. You know, I read the writing on the wall. It presented itself, and immediately I was, you know, I don't want to get into the details, but let me just say, I met this person and it got really fucked up really fast, and I bolted. I was gone, you know, and I made way for whatever it was that God had for me. And it turned out, you know, I had, and I found this, I forgot I had it, right? Years and years had gone by, and I had made this sacred prayer that I actually typed down into the notes in my phone. So I would have it, you know. So I was testing God in a sense, right? And I made this prayer asking for a mate. You know, a woman in my life who had all this varied criteria, right? This detailed stuff, and it was kind of all over the map. And like I said, I forgot about it. And I don't know, a couple of months ago, I was going through notes, like clearing out stuff, making room on the, you know, storage space on the phone, and I stumble on this thing. Totally forgot about it. And I read through it. And don't you know, I mean, word for word, line by line, it describes my wife to a T. And her situation to a T, and all of this other stuff to many other T's. It was a prayer that was perfectly answered, letter by letter, all the way through, without exception. Unfucking believable. And I could only know that in retrospect. I can only know that in hindsight, looking back. Time with a woman who has proven all these things out. Time enough has gone by for me to see that exactly what I asked for is exactly what was given to me. And this woman's road name is Sunflower. And there's your flower. Okay? And I didn't meet her and you know, have her introduce herself as Sunflower. No, I was dating her for, I don't know, 6, 7, 8 months. And she was designated as Sunflower by somebody in the crew. So it's not like I went looking for it, found it, and then made all this shit up. Made it fit my narrative, as the saying goes so commonly these days. No. That narrative came and fit me. And she fits me to a T. I love my wife. She's very good. Very good. So, yes, it's like a lot of times in life, you know, these visions come to you, to me, to people. And we don't necessarily see the meaning of them up front. Sometimes we have to wait for them to come to fruition to understand that they have indeed come to fruition. And it's not the content of the prophetic vision, but the fact that God came through. So consider like the apocalypse, right? The book of Revelation, and how many people are going through it with their great efforts to interpret its meaning and apply the interpretation now, and how fucked up it's been over the centuries, right? Especially the past like 200-300 years here in America, especially, right? Because we're a freedom-oriented civilization over here, right? Western thinking, Western culture, very independent of spirit, very, I don't want to hear the priest, give me the Bible, let me figure it out, right? So that's what we do over here, right? That's what we do in America. That's what we've done. We've got a history of this shit. We've also got a history of shitheads who have got it all wrong and set dates, told you the world was going to end, and people drain their bank accounts and kill their dogs and, you know, meet up on the hill and wait for the spaceship to come and take, and it doesn't fucking happen. And every decade there's another one of it, and another, and another, and another, and there's always something pointing to the end, right? And I got to the point, you know, I read it a lot. I've studied, I've made in-depth studies on the apocalypse, the book of Revelation, right? And my conclusion is there's a lot of things in there that equate very strongly with the history of the church, as it should, because it's, you know, from Jesus, by an angel, to Apostle John, who wrote these things down, and wrote the visions down, and what would these entities, you know, from a saint to an angel to the Messiah, be speaking of first and foremost, other than the church, right? And in fact, this letter, this vision, this apocalypse was written for the seven churches in Asia Minor. It has to be relative to the church. So I read it and I just see like potential symbolic representations of snapshots through the history of the church, past, present, and future, from the perspective of the original intended audience, which is like 2,000 years ago, right? 1,900 years, something like that. But there's a lot of things that are incomplete for a couple of reasons. A, we don't understand the symbolism perfectly because it was meant for people at that time, and things were different back then. Things were different. I'll give you an example, all right? If you say gay now, immediately, first thing comes to your mind, what does it mean, right? Homosexual. But you go back 70 years, you say gay, what does it mean? Happy. Completely different thing. Words change meanings. And now we're reading words, and we're reading them the way we understand them now. But what they were back then was something completely fucking different. That's just a teeny tiny example, right? So we don't get it. We don't get it fully because it was intended for a completely different audience. And then on the other hand, there's some future elements to it that we can't possibly get until it happens. We could try to project, based on the symbolism and our understanding on it, what's going to come to pass. But I think invariably what's going to happen for all of us is that a lot of this shit ain't going to make sense until we're dead and gone and in the afterlife, and everything has come to fruition. And then God's just going to say, look, here we go. This is my prophecy. And everything I said came exactly true the way I said it would. It's about God proving himself out to everybody, okay? It's not about us proving how godly or spiritual or wise or intuitive or intelligent we are. It's all about God. And God sets parameters for himself with this prophecy stuff. He says something's going to happen. It's got to happen, or else what? You have a lot of reason not to believe anymore. It really matters. So anyway, well, that's a lot of stuff. Well, I wasn't planning on going that direction, but there we go. So, yeah. Bucket of tears. Bucket of tears. I'm telling you what. My bucket of tears is dry right now. And I just dumped the trash in the dumpster, and the grounds are clean, and it's another day. The sun is shining, and let's go do this.
Thank you for tuning into Post-Stalin Monologics. Please understand that this project is meant to be part of a long-term archive as a series of snapshots reflecting a distant past. We are not seeking advertisers, but may at times accept private anonymous donations to help mitigate production costs. Further information involving this project and archived releases of Post-Stalin Monologics can be accessed over the World Wide Web at poststalin.com and at onsert.com. Comments, critiques, and inquiries may be submitted to Maverick through email at maverick88@poststalin.com.